light through my porthole, I saw a serpentine length of hawser uncoil itself and a black form heave itself free like the dead at the last trump. A powerful hand seemed to sail through the blackness and sealed my lips ere I could cry out. My assailant hissed, "Missa Ewing, no harm. You safe. I friend of Mr. Darnock. You know he Christian. Please, quiet." Reason at last rallied against my fear. A man, not a spirit, was hiding in my room. If he wished to slit my throat from my hat, shoes, and legal box, I would already be dead. If my jailer was a stowaway, why he, not I, was in peril for his life. From his uncut language, his faint silhouette, and his smell, I intuited the stowaway was an Indian, alone on a boat of 50 white men. "Very well." I nodded slowly to indicate I would not cry out. The cautious hand released my lips. "My name is Artur," he said. "You know I. You seen I. You pity I." I asked what he was talking about. "Maori whip I. You seen." My memory overcame the bizarreness of my situation, and I recalled the Moriori being flogged by the Lizard King. This heartened him. "You good man. Mr. Darnock tell you good man. He hid I in your cabin yesterday night. I escape. You help Mr. Ewing." Now a groan escaped my lips, and his hand clasped my mouth anew. "If you no help, I in trouble dead." All too true, I thought, and moreover, you'll drag me down with you unless I convince Captain Molyneux of my innocence. I burned with resentment at Darnock's act, and burn still. Let him save his good causes and leave innocent bystanders be. I told the stowaway he was already in trouble dead. The Prophetess was a mercantile vessel, not an underground railroad for rescued slaves. "I able seaman," insisted the black. "I earn passage." "Well and good," I told him, dubious of his claim to be a sailor of pedigree, and urged him to surrender himself to the captain's mercies forthwith.
"No, they no listen, I. Swim away home, nigger, they say, and throw I in drink. You lawman, I. You go, you talk, I stay, I hide. Please. Captain hear you, Mr. Ewing. Please."
In vain I sought to convince him. No intercessor at Captain Molyneux's court was less favored than the Yankee Adam Ewing. The Moriori's adventure was his own, and I desired no part in it. His hand found mine and, to my consternation, closed my fingers around the hilt of a dagger. Resolute and bleak was his demand. "Then kill I." With a terrible calmness and certitude, he pressed its tip against his throat. I told the Indian he was mad.
"I not mad. You no help I, you kill I, just same. It's true, you know it."
I implored him to restrain himself and speak soft.
"So kill I. Say to others I attack you, so you kill I. I ain't be fish food, Mr. Ewing. Die here is better."
Cursing my conscience singly, my fortune doubly, and Mr. Darnock trebly, I bade him sheathe his knife and for heaven's sake conceal himself, lest one of the crew hear and come knocking. I promised to approach the captain at breakfast, for to interrupt his slumbers would only ensure the doom of the enterprise. This satisfied the stowaway, and he thanked me. He slid back inside the coils of rope, leaving me to the near impossible task of constructing a case for an aboriginal stowaway aboard an English schooner without attainting his discoverer and cabin mate with a charge of conspiracy. The savage's breathing told me he was sleeping.
I was tempted to make a dash for the door and howl for help, but in the eyes of God, my word was my bond, even to an Indian. The cacophony of timbers creaking, of masts swaying, of ropes flexing, of canvas clapping, of feet on decks, of goats bleating, of rats scuttling, of the pumps beating, of the bell dividing the watches, of melees and laughter from the forecastle, of orders, of windlass shanties, and of Tethys's eternal realm, all lulled me as I calculated how best I could convince Captain Molyneux of my innocence in Mr. Darnock's plot. Now I must be more vigilant than ever that this diary should not be read by unfriendly eyes. When a falsetto yell, beginning far off but speeding nearer at a crossbolt's velocity, was silenced by the deck, mere inches above where I lay. Such a terrible finality. Prone I lay, shocked and rigid, forgetting to breathe. Shouts far and near rose, feet gathered, and an alarum of "Raise Dr. Goose!" cried forth. "Sorry bastard, fall from rigging. Dead now," the Indian whispered as I made haste to investigate the disturbance. "You can nothing, Sir Ewing." I ordered him to stay hidden and hurried out. I fancy the stowaway sensed how tempted I was to use the accident to betray him. The crew stood around a man lying prone at the base of the midmast. By the lurching lantern light, I recognized one of the Castilians. I own that my first emotion was relief that not Raphael but another had fallen to his death. I overheard the Icelander say the dead man had won his compatriot's Eric ration at cards and drunk it all before his watch. Henry arrived in his nightshirt with his doctor's bag. He knelt by the mangled form and felt for a pulse, but shook his head. "This fellow has no need of a doctor." Mr. Roderick retrieved the Castilian's boots and clothes for auction, and Mankin fetched some third-rate sackcloth for the cadaver. Mr. Boerhaafer will deduct the sackcloth from the auction's profits. The jacks returned to their forecastle or their stations in silence, every man made somber by this reminder of the fragility of life. Henry, Mr. Roderick, and I stayed to watch the Castilians perform their Catholic death rites over their countrymen before knotting up the sack and committing his body to the deep with tears and dolorous adios. "Passionate Latinos," observed Henry, bidding me a second good night. I yearned to share the secret of the Indian with my friend, but held my tongue lest my complicity infect him. Returning from the melancholy scene, I saw a lantern gleam in the galley. Finbar sleeps there to ward off pilferers, but he too was roused by the night's excitement. I recalled that the stowaway may not have eaten for a day and a half, fearfully, for what bestial depravity might a savage not be driven to by an empty stomach? My act might have stood against me on the morrow, but I told the cook a mighty hunger was robbing me of sleep, and, at double the usual expense, on account of the unseasonable hour, I procured a platter of sauerkraut, sausage, and buns hard as cannonballs. Back in the confines of my cabin, the savage thanked me for the kindness and ate that humble fare as if it were a presidential banquet. I did not confess my true motives, viz., the fuller his stomach, the less likely he was to consume me, but instead asked him why, during his flogging, he had smiled at me. "Pain is strong, aye, but friend's eyes more strong." I told him that he knows next to nothing about me, and I know nothing about him. He jabbed at his eyes and jabbed at mine, as if that single gesture were ample explanation. The wind rose higher as the middle watch wore on, making the timbers moan and whipping up the seas and sluicing over the decks. Sea water was soon dripping into my coffin, trickling down the walls and blotting my blanket. "You might have chosen a drier hidey-hole than mine," I whispered, to test the stowaway's wakefulness. Safe better'n dry, Miss Ewing, he murmured, alert as I.
Why, I asked, was he beaten so savagely in the Indian hamlet?
A silence stretched itself out.
I seen too much of the world. I ain't good slave.
To ward off seasickness during those dreary hours, I teased out the stowaway's history. I cannot, moreover, deny my curiosity. His pigeon delivered his tale brokenly, so its substance only shall I endeavor to set down here.
White men's ships bore vicissitudes to old Rikohu, as Mr. Darnock narrated, but also marvels. During my stowaway's boyhood, Otua yearned to learn more of these pale peoples from places whose existence, in his grandfather's time, was the realm of myths. Otua claims his father had been amongst the natives Lieutenant Broughton's landing party encountered in Skirmish Bay, and spent his infancy hearing the yarn told and retold of the great albatross paddling through the morning mists, its vividly plumaged, strangely jointed servants who canoed ashore, facing backwards, of the albatross servants' gibberish, a bird language, of their smoke breathing, of their heinous violation of that tapu forbidding strangers to touch canoes. Doing so curses the vessel and renders it as unseaworthy as if an axe had been taken to it. Of the pursuant altercation, of those shouting staffs whose magical wrath could kill a man across the beach, and of the bright skirt of ocean blue, cloud white, and blood red that the servants hoisted aloft a pole before rowing back to the great albatross. This flag was removed and presented to a chieftain who wore it proudly until the scrofula took him.
Otua had an uncle, Koche, who shipped aboard a Boston sealer circa 1825. The stowaway is unsure of his exact age. Moriori were prized crew amongst such vessels, for in lieu of martial prowess, Rikohu's manhood won their spurs by seal hunting and swimming feats. To claim his bride, as a further example, a young man had to dive to the seabed and surface with a crayfish in each hand and a third in his mouth. Newly discovered Polynesians, it should be added, make easy prey for unscrupulous captains. Otua's uncle Koche returned after 5 years, garbed in pakeha clothes with rings in his ears, a modest pouch of dollars and reals, possessed of strange customs, smoke breathing amongst them, discordant oaths and tales of cities and sights too outlandish for the Moriori tongue to delineate. Otua swore to ship on the next vessel leaving Ocean Bay and see these exotic places for himself. His uncle persuaded a second mate on a French whaler to ship the 10-year-old Otua as an apprentice. In the Moriori's subsequent career at sea, he saw the ice ranges of Antarctica, whales turned to islets of gore, then barrels of sperm oil. In the becalmed ashy Encantadas, he hunted giant tortoises. In Sydney, he saw grand buildings, parks, horse-drawn carriages, and ladies in bonnets, and the miracles of civilization. He shipped opium from Calcutta to Canton, survived dysentery in Batavia, lost half of an ear in a skirmish with Mexicans afore the altar at Santa Cruz, survived shipwreck at the Horn and saw Rio de Janeiro, though he did not step ashore, and everywhere he observed that casual brutality lighter races show the darker. Otua returned in the summer of 1835, a worldly wise young man of about 20. He planned to take a local bride and build a house and cultivate some acres, but as Mr. Darnock relates, by the winter solstice of that year every Moriori who had not perished was a slave of the Maori. The returnee's years amongst crews of all nations did not elevate Otua in the invader's estimation. I observed how ill-timed was the prodigal's homecoming.
No, Miss Ewing, Rikohu called me home, so I see her death, so I know.
He tapped his head.
the truth.
Otua's master was the lizard-tattooed Maori, Kupaka, who told his horrified, broken slaves that he had come to cleanse them of their false idols. "Have your gods saved you?" taunted Kupaka. "Their polluted language. My whip will teach you pure Maori. Their tainted blood. Inbreeding has diluted your original mana." Henceforth, Moriori unions were prescribed, and all issue fathered by Maori men on Moriori women were declared Maori. The earliest transgressors were executed in gruesome ways, and the survivors lived in that state of lethargy engendered by relentless subjugation. Otua cleared land, planted wheat, and tended hogs for Kupaka until he won enough trust to effect his escape. "Secret places on Rikohu, Missa Ewing. Combs, pitfalls, caves deep in Motoporoporo forest, so dense no dogs sent you there." "I fancy I fell into one such secret place." A year later he was recaptured, but Moriori slaves were now too scarce to be indiscriminately slaughtered. The lower Maori were obliged to labor alongside the serfs, much to their disgust. "We forsook our ancestors' land in Aotearoa for this miserable rock," they complained. Otua escaped again, and during his second spell of freedom, he was granted secret asylum by Mr. Darnock for some months, at no little risk to the latter. During this sojourn, Otua was baptized and turned to the Lord. Kupaka's men caught up with the fugitive after a year and 6 months, but this time the mercurial chieftain evinced a respect for Otua's spirit. After a retributive lashing, Kupaka appointed his slave as fisherman for his own table. Thus employed, the Moriori let another year go by until, one afternoon, he found a rare moika fish flapping in his net. He told Kupaka's wife this king of fish could be eaten only by a king of men, and showed her how to prepare it for her husband. "Bad, bad poison, this moika fish, Missa Ewing. One bite, aye, you sleep, you never wake no mo." During that night's feasting, Otua snuck from the encampment, stole his master's canoe, and rowed across the current-prone, choppy, moonless sea to deserted Pitt Island, 2 leagues to the south of Chatham Isle, known as Rangiora in Moriori and revered as mankind's birthplace. Luck favored the stowaway, for he arrived safe at dawn as a squall blew up and no canoes made the crossing after him. Otua subsisted in his Polynesian Eden on wild celery, watercress, eggs, berries, an occasional young boar. He risked fires only under cover of darkness or mist, and the knowledge that Kupaka at least had met a condign punishment. Was his solitude not unbearable? Nights, ancestors visited. Days, I yarned tales of Maui to birds, and birds yarned sea tales to I. The fugitive lived thus for many a season until last September, when a winter gale wrecked the whaler Eliza from Nantucket on Pitt Island Reef. All hands drowned, but our Mr. Walker, zealous in his pursuit of easy guineas, crossed the straits seeking salvage. When he found signs of habitation and saw Kupaka's old canoe, each is storiated with unique carvings, he knew he had found treasure of interest to his Maori neighbors. 2 days later, a large hunting party rowed to Pitt Island from the mainland. Otua sat on the beach and watched them arrive, surprised only to see his old enemy, Kupaka, grizzled but very much alive and shouting war chants. My uninvited cabin mate concluded his tale. "That bastard's greedy dog stole Moika from kitchen and died, not the Maori. Aye, Kupaka flogged me, but he's old and far from home and his mana is hollow and starved. Maori thrive on wars and revenge and feudin', but peace kills 'em off. Many go back to Zealand. Kupaka cannot. His land is no mo'.
Then last week, Miss Ewing, I see you, and I know. You save I know it.
The morning watch smote four bells, and my porthole betrayed a rainy dawn. I had slept a little, but my prayers that the dawn would dissolve the Moriori were unheeded. I bade him to play act. He had only just revealed himself, and make no mention of our night's conversation. He signaled comprehension, but I feared the worst. An Indian's wit was no match for a Boerhaave. Along the gangway I stepped, the prophetess was bucking like a young bronco, to the officer's mess, knocked, and entered. Mr. Roderick and Mr. Boerhaave were listening to Captain Molyneux. I cleared my throat and bade all good morning, at which our amicable captain swore, "You can better my morning by buggering off instanter." Coolly, I asked when the captain might find time to hear news of an Indian stowaway who had just emerged from the coils of hawser, taking up my so-called cabin. During the ensuing silence, Captain Molyneux's pale, horny-toed complexion turned roast beef pink. Ere his blast was launched, I added the stowaway claimed to be an able seaman and begged to work his passage. Mr. Boerhaave forestalled his captain with the predicted accusations and exclaimed, "On Dutch merchantmen, those who abet stowaways share their fate." I reminded the Hollander we sailed under an English flag and put it to him why, if I had hid the stowaway under the coils of hawser, had I asked and asked again since Thursday night for the unwanted hawser to be removed, thereby begging for my putative conspiracy to be uncovered. Hitting that bullseye fired my mettle, and I assured Captain Molyneux that the baptized stowaway had resorted to this extreme measure lest his Maori master, who had vowed to eat his slave's warm liver. I sprinkled a little seasoning on my version of events, directed his ungodly wrath towards his rescuer. Mr. Boerhaave swore, "So this damned blackamoor wants us to be grateful to him?" "No," I replied, "the Moriori asks for a chance to prove his value to the prophetess." Mr. Boerhaave spat out, "A stowaway is a stowaway even if he shits silver nuggets. What's his name?" "I did not know," I replied, "for I had not conducted an interview with the man, but come to the captain expeditiously." Captain Molyneux spoke at last. "Able seaman, first class, you say?" His wrath had cooled at the prospect of earning a valuable pair of hands he would not have to pay. "An Indian? Where did he salt his burns?" I repeated, 2 minutes was insufficient to learn his history, but my instinct considered the Indian an honest fellow. The captain wiped his beard. "Mr. Roderick, accompany our passenger and his instinct and fetch their pet savage afoot the mizzen." He tossed a key to his first mate. "Mr. Boerhaave, my fowling piece, if you please." The second mate and I did as bid. "A risky business," Mr. Roderick warned me. "The only statute book on the prophetess is the old man's whim." "Another statute book named Conscience is observed lex loci, wherever God sees," I responded. Otua was awaiting his trial in the cotton trousers I purchased in Port Jackson. He had climbed aboard from Mr. Darnock's boat in naught but his savage's loincloth and a shark-tooth necklace. His back was exposed. His lacerations, I hoped, would pay testimony to his resilience and bestir sympathy in the observer's breasts. Rats behind the arras spread tidings of the sport, and most hands were gathered on deck. My ally, Henry, was still abed, unaware of my jeopardy. Captain Molyneux sized the Moriori up as if inspecting a mule and addressed him thus. "Mr. Ewing, who knows nothing about how you boarded my vessel, says you regard yourself a seaman." Otua replied with courage and dignity. "Aye, Captain, sir. 2 years on Whaler, Mississippi of La Havre under Captain Maspero, and 4 years on Cornucopia of Philadelphia under Captain Caton. 3 years on an Indiaman—" Captain Molyneux interrupted and indicated Otua's trousers.
Did you pilfer this garment from below?
Artua was sensible that I, too, was on trial.
That Christian gentleman gave, sir.
The crew followed the stowaway's finger to myself, and Mr. Boerhaafer thrust at the chink in my armor.
He did. When was this gift awarded?
I recalled my father-in-law's aphorism, to fool a judge, feign fascination, but to bamboozle the whole court, feign boredom. And I pretended to extract a speck from my eye.
Artua answered with primed percipience.
10 minutes passed, sir. I, no clothes, that gentleman say. Naked, no good, dress this.
If you are a seaman, our captain jerked his thumb aloft, let's see you lower this midmast's royal.
At this, the stowaway grew hesitant and confused, and I felt the lunatic's wager I had placed on this Indian's word swing against me. But Artua had merely spotted a trap.
Sir, this mast ain't midmast. This mast the mizzen, aye?
Impassive, Captain Molyneux nodded.
Then kindly lower the mizzen, royal.
Artua fairly ran up the mast, and I began to hope all was not lost. The newly risen sun shone low over the water and caused us to squint.
"Ready and aim my piece," the captain instructed Mr. Boerhaafer, once the stowaway was past the spanker gaff. "Fire on my command."
Now I protested with the utmost vigor. The Indian had received holy sacrament. But Captain Molyneux ordered me to shut up or swim back to the Chathams. No American captain would cut a man down, not even a nigger, so odiously. Artua reached the topmost yard and walked it with simian dexterity despite the rough seas. Watching the sail unfurl, one of the saltest aboard, a dour Icelander and a sober, obliging, and hard-working fellow, spoke his admiration for all to hear.
The darky's salt as I am. Aye, he's got fish hooks for toes.
Such was my gratitude, I could have kissed his boots. Soon Artua had the sail down, a difficult operation even for a team of 4 men. Captain Molyneux grunted approval and ordered Mr. Boerhaafer to replace his gun.
But damn me if I pay a stowaway a single cent. He'll work his passage to O'Hawaii. If he's no shirker, he may sign articles there in the regular fashion. Mr. Roderick, he can share the dead Spaniard's bunk.
I have worn away a nib in narrating the day's excitements. It is grown too dark to see. Wednesday, the 20th of November. Strong easterly breeze, very salty and oppressive. Henry has conducted his examination and has grave news, yet not the gravest. My ailment is a parasite, gusano coco cervello. This worm is endemic throughout both Melanesia and Polynesia, but has been known to science only these last 10 years. It breeds in the stinking canals of Batavia, doubtless the port of my own infection. Ingested, it voyages through the host's blood vessels to the brain's cerebellum anterior, hence my migraines and dizziness. Ensconced in the brain, it enters a gestation phase.
"You are a realist, Adam," Henry told me, "so your pills shall be unsugared. Once the parasite larvae hatch, the victim's brain becomes a maggoty cauliflower. Putrescent gases cause the eardrums and eyeballs to protrude until they pop, releasing a cloud of gusano coco spores."
Thus reads my death sentence, but now comes my stay of execution and appeal. An admixture of Eurusium alkali and Orinoco manganese will calcify my parasite, and laphrodictic myrrh will disintegrate it. Henry's apothecary holds these compounds, but a precise dosage is paramount. Less than half a dram leaves gusano coco unpurged, but more kills the patient with the cure. My doctor warns me that as the parasite dies, its poison sacs split and secrete their cargo, so I shall feel worse before my recovery is complete.
Henry enjoined me not to breathe a word about my condition, for hyenas like Boerhaave prey on the vulnerable, and ignorant sailors can show hostility to maladies they know not. I once heard of a sailor who showed the touch of leprosy a week out of Macau on the long haul back to Lisbon, recalled Henry, and the whole company prodded the wretch overboard without a hearing. During my convalescence, Henry shall inform the scuttlebutt that Mr. Ewing has a low fever caused by the climb and nurse me himself. Henry bridled when I mentioned his fee.
Fee? You are no valetudinarian viscount with banknotes padding his pillows. Providence steered you to my ministrations, for I doubt 5 men in this blue Pacific can cure you. So a fie on fee. All I ask, dear Adam, is that you are an obedient patient. Kindly take my powders and withdraw to your cabin. I shall look in after the last dog.
My doctor is an uncut diamond of the first water. Even as I write these words, I am tearful with gratitude. Saturday, the 30th of November. Henry's powders are indeed a wondrous medicament. I inhale the precious grains into my nostrils from an ivory spoon, and on the instant an incandescent joy burns my being. My senses grow alert, yet my limbs grow Lethean. My parasite still writhes at night like a new babe's finger, igniting spasms of pain, and dreams obscene and monstrous visit me. A sure sign, Henry consoles me. Your worm has reacted to our vermicide and seeks shelter in the recesses of your cerebral canals, whence visions spring. In vain, Gusano Coco hides, dear Adam, in vain. We shall winkle him out. Monday, the 2nd of December. By day my coffin is hot as an oven, and my sweat dampens these pages. The tropic sun fattens and fills the noon sky. The men work semi-naked with sun-blacked torsos and straw hats. The planking oozes scorching tar that sticks to one's soles. Rain squalls blow up from nowhere and vanish with the same rapidity, and the deck hisses itself dry in a minute. Portuguese man-o'-wars pulsate in the quicksilver sea. Flying fish bewitch the beholder, and ochre shadows of hammerheads circle the prophetess. Earlier I stepped on a squid that had propelled itself over the bulwarks. Its eyes and beak reminded me of my father-in-law. The water we took on at Chatham Isle is now brackish, and without a dash of brandy in it my stomach rebels. When not playing chess in Henry's cabin or the mess room, I rest in my coffin until Homer lulls me into dreams abillow with sails of Athenians. Artua knocked on my coffin door yesterday to thank me for saving his neck. He said he was in my debt, true enough, until the day he saves my life. May it never dawn. I asked how he was finding his new duties. Better than slaving for Kupaka, Mr. Ewing. Anyhow, growing sensible of my fear someone would witness our Congress and report to Captain Molyneux, the Moriori returned to the forecastle and has not since sought me out. As Henry warns me, it's one thing to throw a blackie a bone, but quite another to take him on for life. Friendships between races, Ewing, can never surpass the affection between a loyal gun dog and its master. Nightly, my doctor and I enjoy a stroll on the deck before retiring. It is pleasant merely to breathe the cooler air. One loses one's eye in lanes of sea phosphorescence and the Mississippi of stars streaming across the heavens. Last night, the men were gathered on the foredeck laying up grass into sinnet for ropes by lantern light, and the prohibition on supernumeraries on the foredeck seemed not to apply. Since the Artua incident, that contempt directed at Mr. Quillcock is in recess, as is the epithet. Bentnail sang 10 verses on the world's brothels foul enough to put the most wanton satyr to flight. Henry volunteered an 11th verse,
about Mary O'Hare of Inverary, that turned the air yet bluer. Raphael was next coerced to take his turn. He sat on the widowmaker and sang these lines in a voice unschooled, yet honest and true. O Shenandoah, I long to see you. Hurrah, you rolling river. O Shenandoah, I'll not deceive you. We are bound way across the wide Missouri. O Shenandoah, I love your daughter. I love the place across the water. The ship sails free, the wind is blowing. The braces taut, the sheets are flowing. Missouri, she's a mighty river. We'll brace her up till her topsails shiver. O Shenandoah, I'll leave you never. Till the day I die, I'll love you ever. Silence from rude mariners is a grander accolade than any erudite eulogy. Why should Raphael, an Australian-born lad, have an American song by heart? I didn't know 'twas a Yankee-in, he replied awkwardly. My mam teached it me before she died. It's the only thing of hers I got still. It stuck in me. He turned to his work, an awkward curtness in his manner. Henry and I sensed anew the hostility that workers emanate at the bystanding idler, and so we left the toilers to their industry. Reading my entry for the 15th of October, when first I met Raphael during our shared mal de mer on the Tasman Sea, I stand amazed at how that sprite lad, aglow with excitement at his maiden voyage and so eager to please, has become this sullen youth in only 6 weeks. His luminous beauty is chipped away, revealing the timber-muscled seaman he shall become. Already he looks rather given to rum and water. Henry says this sloughing off of his cocoon is inevitable, bon gré mal gré, and I suppose he is right. Those smatterings of education and sensibility Raphael received from his patron, Mrs. Fry of Brisbane, serve a cabin boy ill in the harum-scarum world of the forecastle. How I wish I could help him. Were it not for the intervention of my Mr. and Mrs. Channing, my own fate may well have been of a piece with Raph's. I asked Finbar if he thought the boy was fitting in well. Finbar's Delphic reply, "Fitting what in well, Mr. Ewing?" left the galley cackling, but myself, quite in the dark. Saturday, the 7th of December. Petrels are aloft, sooty turns afloat, and Mother Carey's chickens roost on the rigging. Fish similar to Borettos pursued fish similar to sprats. As Henry and I ate supper, a blizzard of purplish moths seemed to issue from the cracks in the moon, smothering lanterns, faces, food, and every surface in a twitching sheet of wings. To confirm these portents of nearby islands, a man at the ledge shouted a depth of only 18 fathoms. Mr. Boerhaave ordered the anchor to be weighed lest we drift onto a reef in the night. The whites of my eyes have a lemon-yellow aspect, and their rims are reddened and sore. Henry assures me this symptom is welcome, but has obliged my request for an increased dosage of vermicide. Sunday, the 8th of December. Sabbath not being observed on the prophetess, this morning Henry and I decided to conduct a short Bible reading in his cabin in the low church style of Ocean Bay's congregation, astraddle the forenoon and morning watches, so both starboard and port shifts might...
Letters from Zedelchem. Chateau Zedelchem, Nierbeke, West Vlaanderen, 29th, 6, 1931. Sixsmith. Dreamt I stood in a china shop, so crowded from floor to far-off ceiling with shelves of porcelain antiquities, etc., that moving a muscle would cause several to fall and smash to bits. Exactly what happened. But instead of a crashing noise, an august chord rang out, half cello, half celeste, D major, question mark, held for 4 beats. My wrist knocked a Ming vase affair off its pedestal, E-flat, whole string section, glorious, transcendent, angels wept. deliberately now smashed a figurine of an ox for the next note, then a milkmaid, then Saturday's child. Orgy of shrapnel filled the air, divine harmonies my head. Ah, such music! Glimpsed my father totting up the smashed item's value, nib flashing, but had to keep the music coming. Knew I'd become the greatest composer of the century if I could only make this music mine. A monstrous laughing cavalier flung against the wall set off a thumping battery of percussion. Woke in my imperial western suite. Tam Brewer's collectors nearly knocking my door down, and much commotion from corridor. Hadn't even waited until I'd shaved. Breathtaking vulgarity of these ruffians. Had no choice but to exit swiftly via the bathroom window before the brouhaha summoned the manager to discover that the young gentleman in room 237 had no means of settling his now hefty balance. Escape was not hitchless, sorry to report. Drainpipe ripped free of its mounting with the noise of a brutalized violin, and down, down, down tumbled your old chum. Right buttock one hellish bruise. Minor miracle I didn't shatter my spine or impale myself on railings. Learn from this, Sixsmith. When insolvent, pack minimally, with a valise tough enough to be thrown onto a London pavement from a first or second floor window. Insist on hotel rooms no higher. Hid in a tea-room tucked into a sooty nook of Victoria Station, trying to transcribe the music from the China Shop of Dreams. Couldn't get beyond a measly 2 bars. Would have walked into Tam Brewer's arms just to have that music back again. Miserable spirits. Labouring types surrounded me with bad teeth, parrot voices, and unfounded optimism. Sobering to think how one accursed night of baccarat can alter a man's social standing so irreversibly. Those shop workers, cabbies, and tradesmen had more half-crowns and threepenny bits squirreled away in their sour Stepney mattresses than I, son of an ecclesiastical somebody, can claim. Had a view of an alley, downtrodden scriveners hurtling by like demi-semi-quavers in a Beethoven allegro. Afraid of 'em? No, I'm afraid of being one. What value are education, breeding, and talent if one doesn't have a pot to piss in? Still can't believe it. I, a keys man, teetering on the brink of destitution. Decent hotels won't let me taint their lobbies now. Indecent hotels demand cash on the nail, and barred from any reputable gaming table this side of the Pyrenees. Anyway, I summarized my options. 1. Use paltry funds to obtain a dirty room in some lodging house, beg a few guineas from Uncle Cecil Limited, teach prissy misses their scales and bitter spinsters their technique. Come now. If I could fake courtesy to dunces, I'd still be swabbing Professor Macaris's arse with my ex-fellow undergrads. No, before you say it, I can't go running back to Pater with yet another cri de coeur. Would validate every poisonous word he said about me. Would rather jump off Waterloo Bridge and let old Father Thames humble me. Mean it. 2. Hunt down Keys people, butter 'em up, and invite myself to stay for the summer. Problematic, for same reasons as 1. How long could I conceal my starving pocketbook? How long could I stave off their pity, their talons? 3. Visit turf accountant. But if I lost? You'd remind me I brought it all upon myself, Sixsmith. But shrug off that middle-class chip on your shoulder and stick with me a little longer. Across a crowded platform, a guard announced that the Dover-bound train for the ship to Ostend was delayed by 30 minutes. That guard was my croupier, inviting me to double or quits. If one will just be still, shut up and listen. Lo, behold, the world will sift through one's ideas for one, especially in a grimy London railway station. Downed my soapy tea and strode across the concourse to the ticket office. A return ticket to Ostend was too costly, so parlous has my position become. So a single it had to be. Boarded my carriage just as the locomotive's whistle blasted forth a swarm of piccolo furies. We were under way. Now to reveal my plan, inspired by a piece in The Times and a long soak's daydream in my Savoy suite. In the Belgian backwaters, south of Bruges, there lives a reclusive English composer named Vivian Ayres. You won't have heard of him because you're a musical oaf, but he's one of the greats, the only Briton of his generation to reject pomp, circumstance, rusticity, and charm. hasn't produced any new work since the early 20s due to illness. He's half blind and can hardly hold a pen. But the Times review of his Secular Magnificat, performed last week at St. Martin's, referred to a drawerful of unfinished works. My daydream had me travelling to Belgium, persuading Vivian Ayres he needed to employ me as an amanuensis, accepting his offer to tutor me, shooting through the musical firmament, winning fame and fortune commensurate to my gifts, obliging Pater to admit that, yes, the son he disinherited is the Robert Frobisher, greatest British composer of his time. Why not? Had no better plan. You groan and shake your head, Sixsmith, I know, but you smile too, which is why I love you. Uneventful journey to the Channel. Cancerous suburbs, tedious farmland, soiled Sussex, Dover an utter fright, staffed by Bolsheviks, versified cliffs as romantic as my arse, and a similar hue. Changed last shillings into francs at the port and took my cabin aboard the Kentish Queen, a rusty tub that looks old enough to have seen service in Crimea. Spud-faced young steward and I disagreed his burgundy uniform and unconvincing beard were worth a tip. Sneered at my valise and manuscript folder, "Wise of you to travel light, sir," and left me to muck for myself. Suited me fine. Dinner was balsawood chicken, powdery potatoes, and a bastard claret. My dining-table companion was Mr. Victor Bryant, cutlery lordling of Sheffield. Not a musical bone in his body. He expounded on the subject of spoons for most of the meal, mistook my civil deportment for interest, and offered me a job in his sales department on the spot. Can you believe it? Thanked him, keeping straight face, and confessed I'd rather swallow cutlery than ever have to sell the stuff. 3 mighty blasts on the foghorn, engines changed timbre, felt the ship cast off, went on deck to watch Albion withdraw into drizzly murk. No going back now. Consequences of what I'd done struck home. RVW conducting Sea Symphony in the Orchestra of the Mind. Sail forth, steer for the deep waters only, reckless, O soul, exploring, I with thee, and thou with me. Don't much care for this work, but it was perfectly programmed. North Sea wind had me shivering, spray licked me from toe to crown. Glossy black waters invited me to jump. Ignored 'em. Turned in early, leafed through noise contrapuntals, listened to the distant brass of the engine room, and sketched a repetitive passage for trombone based on the ship's rhythms, but was rather rubbish, and then guess who came a-knocking at my door? The spud-faced steward, his shift over. Gave him rather more than a tip. No Adonis, scrawny, but inventive for his class. Turfed him out afterwards and sank into the sleep of the dead. One part of me wanted that voyage never to end. But end it did. Kentish Queen slid into Dover's snaggle-toothed twin sister over the mucky water, Ostend, the lady of dubious virtue. Early, early morning. Europe's snoring rumbled deep below base tubers. Saw my first aboriginal Belgians hauling crates, arguing and thinking in Flemish, Dutch, whatever. Packed my valise sharpish, afraid the ship might sail back to England with me still aboard, or rather afraid of my letting this happen. Grabbed a bite from the first-class galley's fruit bowl and dashed down the gangplank before anyone with braiding on his uniform caught up with me. Set foot on continental macadam and asked a customs man where I might find the railway station. He pointed toward a groaning tram packed with malnourished workmen, rickets and penury. Prefer Chank's pony, drizzle or no drizzle. Followed tram lines down Coffin-esque streets. Ostend is all tapioca greys and stained browns. Would admit I was thinking Belgium was a bee-stupid country to run away to. Bought a ticket for Bruges and hauled myself aboard the next train. No platforms, can you believe it? A decrepit, empty train. Moved compartment, because mine smelt unpleasant, but all compartments had same pong. Smoked cigarettes cadged off Victor Bryant to purify the air. The station master's whistle blew on time. The locomotive strained like a gouty proctor on the pot before heaving itself into motion. Soon steaming through a foggy landscape of unkempt dikes and blasted copses at a fair old clip. If my plan bears fruit, Sixsmith, you may come to Bruges before V. Long. When you do, arrive in that 6 o'clock in the morning Nocinesque hour. Lose yourself in the city's rickety streets, blind canals, wrought-iron gates, uninhabited courtyards. May I go on? Why, thank you. Leery Gothic carapaces, Ararat roofs, shrubbery-tufted brick spires, medieval overhangs, laundry sagging from windows, cobbled whirlpools that suck your eye in, clockwork princes and chipped princesses striking their hours, sooty doves and three or four octaves of bells, some sober, some bright. Aroma of fresh bread led me to a bakery, where a deformed woman with no nose sold me a dozen crescent moon pastries. Only wanted one, but thought she had enough problems. A rag-and-bone cart clattered out of the mist, and its toothless driver spoke companionably to me, but I could only reply, "Excusez-moi, je ne parle pas flamande," which made him laugh like the Goblin King. Gave him a pastry. His filthy hand was a scabby claw. In a poor quarter, alleys stank of effluent, children helped their mothers at the pumps, filling broken jugs with brown water. Finally, the excitement all caught up with me, sat on the steps of a dying windmill for a breather, wrapped myself against the damp, fell asleep. Next thing, a witch was poking me awake with her broomstick, screeching something like, "Ziggy dod mishin," but don't quote me. Blue sky, warm sun, not a wisp of fog to be seen. Resurrected and blinking, I offered her a pastry. She accepted, with distrust, put it in her apron for later, and got back to her sweeping, growling an ancient ditty. Lucky I wasn't robbed, I suppose. Shared another pastry with 5,000 pigeons to the envy of a beggar, so I had to give him one too. Walked back the way I might have come. In an odd pentagonal window, a creamy maiden was arranging St. Paulia in a cut-glass bowl. Girls fascinate in different ways. Try 'em one day. Tapped on the pane and asked in French if she'd save my life by falling in love with me. Shook her head, but got an amused smile. Asked where I could find a police station. She pointed over a crossroads. One can spot a fellow musician in any context, even amongst policemen. The craziest-eyed, unruliest-haired one, either hungry, skinny, or jovial, portly. This French-speaking, corps anglaise-playing, local operatic society belonging inspector had heard of Vivian Ayres and kindly drew me a map to Nierbeke. Paid him two pastries for this intelligence. He asked if I had shipped over my British car. His son was mad keen about Austin's. Said I had no car. This worried him. How would I get to Nierbeke? No bus, no train line, and 25 miles was the devil of a walk. Asked if I could borrow a policeman's bicycle for an indefinite period. Told me that was most irregular. Assured him I was most irregular, and outlined the nature of my mission to Ayres. Belgium's most famous adopted son. Must be so few, that might even be true. In the service of European music. Repeated my request. Implausible truth can serve one better than plausible fiction, and now was such a time. The honest sergeant took me to a compound where lost items await rightful owners for a few months, before finding their way to the black market. But first he wanted my opinion on his baritone. He gave me a burst of recitar, veste la giubba, from I Pagliacci. A pleasant enough voice in lower registers, but his breathing needed work, and his vibrato quivered like a backstage thunderboard. Gave a few musical pointers, received the loan of a Victorian Enfield plus cord to secure valise and folder to the saddle and rear mudguard. He wished me bon voyage and fair weather. Adrian would never have marched along the road I bicycled out of Bruges, too deep in Hun territory, but nonetheless felt an affinity with my brother by virtue of breathing the same air of the same land. The plain is flat as the fens, but in bad shape. Along the way I fueled myself with the last pastries and stopped at impoverished cottages for cups of water. Nobody said much, but nobody said no. Thanks to a headwind and a chain that kept slipping off, the afternoon was growing old before I finally reached Ayres's home village of Nierbeke. A silent blacksmith showed me how to get to Chateau Zedelkrem by elaborating my map with a pencil stub. A lane, with harebells and toad-flax growing in the middle, led me past a deserted lodge-house to a once stately avenue of mature Italian poplars. Zedelkrem is grander than our rectory, some crumbly turrets adorn its west wing, but it couldn't hold a candle to Audley End or Cape and Tench's country seat. Spied a girl riding a horse over a low hill, crowned by a shipwrecked beech tree. Past a gardener spreading soot against the slugs in a vegetable garden. In the forecourt, a muscle-bound valet was decoking a cowley flat nose. Seeing my approach, he rose and waited for me. In a terraced corner of this frieze, a man in a wheelchair sat under foamy wisteria listening to the wireless. Vivian Ayres, I presumed. The easy part of my daydream was over. Leant the bicycle against the wall, told the valet I had business with his master. He was civil enough and led me around to Ayres's terrace and announced my arrival in German. Ayres, a husk of a man, as if his illness had sucked all juice out of him, but stopped myself kneeling on the cinder path like Sir Percival before King Arthur. Our overture proceeded more or less like this. "Good afternoon, Mr. Ayres. Who in hell are you? It's a great honour to—" "I said, who in hell are you? Robert Frobisher, sir, from Saffron Walden. I was a student of Sir Trevor Maccarus at Caius College, and I've come all the way from London to—" "All the way from London on a bicycle? No, I borrowed the bicycle from a policeman in Bruges."
"Did you?"
Pause for thought.
"Must have taken hours."
"A labour of love, sir, like pilgrims climbing hills on their knees."
"What balderdash is this?"
"I wish to prove I'm a serious applicant."
"Serious applicant for what?"
"The post of your amanuensis."
"Are you mad?"
Always a trickier question than it looks.
"I doubt it." "Look here, I've not advertised for an amanuensis."
"I know, sir, but you need one, even if you don't know it yet."
"Well, the Times piece said that you're unable to compose new works because of your illness.
I can't allow your music to be lost. It's far, far too precious. So I'm here to offer you my services." Well, he didn't dismiss me out of hand.
"What did you say your name was?"
I told him.
"One of Maccarus's shooting stars, are you?"
"Frankly, sir, he loathed me." As you've learned to your cost, I can be intriguing when I put my mind to it.
"He did he? Why might that be?"
"I called his sixth concerto for flute," I cleared my throat, "a slave of prepubescent Saint-Saëns at his most florid in the college magazine. He took it personally."
"You wrote that about Maccarus?"
Ayres wheezed as if his ribs were being sawed.
"I'll bet he took it personally."
The sequel is short. The valet showed me into a drawing-room decorated in eggshell green, a dull farquharson of sheep and cornstooks, and a not very good Dutch landscape. Ayres summoned his wife, Mrs. Van Utrecht de Crommelink. She kept her own name, and with a name like that, who can blame her? The lady of the house was coolly courteous and inquired into my background, answered truthfully, though I veiled my expulsion from Caius behind an obscure malady. Of my present financial straits I breathed not a word. The more desperate the case, the more reluctant the donor. Charmed them sufficiently, it was agreed I could at least stay the night at Zelhem. Ayres would put me through my musical paces in the morning, permitting a decision on my proposal. Ayres did not appear at dinner, however. My arrival coincided with the start of a fortnightly migraine, which confines him to his rooms for a day or two. My audition is postponed until he is better, so my fate still hangs in the balance. On the credit side, the peas porter and lobster à l'américain were the equal to anything at the Imperial. Encouraged my hostess to talk, think she was flattered at how much I know about her illustrious husband, and sensed my genuine love of his music. Oh, we ate with Ayres's daughter, too, the young equestrienne I'd glimpsed earlier. Mademoiselle Ayres is a horsey creature of 17 with her mamma's retroussé nose. Couldn't get a civil word out of her all evening. Might she see in me a louche English freeloader down on his luck, here to lure her sickly father into a glorious Indian summer where she can't follow and isn't welcome? People are complicated. Gone midnight. The chateau is sleeping. So must I. Sincerely, R.F. Zelhem, 6th, 7th, 1931. A telegram, Sixsmith? You ass! Don't send any more, I beg you. Telegrams attract attention. Yes, I'm still abroad. Yes, safe from brewer's knuckle men. Fold my parents' mortifying letter into a paper boat and sail it down the Cam. Pater's only concerned because my creditors are shaking him to see if any banknotes drop from the family tree. Debts of a disinherited son, however, are nobody's business but the son's. Believe me, I've looked into the legalities. Mater is not frantic. Only the prospect of the decanter running dry could make Mater frantic.
My audition took place in Ayres's music room after lunch the day before yesterday. Not an overwhelming success, putting it mildly. No knowing how many days I'll be here, or how few. Admit to a certain frisson sitting on Vivian Ayres's own piano stool beforehand. This oriental rug, battered divan, Breton cupboards crammed with music stands, Ozendorfer Grand, Carillon,